I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you can finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the Teaching Company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled The History of Ancient Egypt, Part 1. The lecturer is Professor Bob Breyer. Professor Breyer is an Egyptologist and professor of philosophy at the C.W. Post campus of Long Island University. A native New Yorker, Professor Breyer was born in the Bronx, where he still lives today. He received his Ph.D. in philosophy from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill in 1970. He began teaching at C.W. Post campus in 1972. From 1981 to 1996, he served as chairman of the philosophy department. He has also served as the director of the National Endowment for the Humanities Egyptology Today program. Professor Breyer has twice been selected as a Fulbright Scholar and is a recipient of the David Newton Award for Teaching Excellence. In 1994, Professor Breyer became the first person in 2,000 years to mummify a human cadaver in the ancient Egyptian style. This research was the subject of a National Geographic television special, Mr. Mummy. Dr. Breyer is also the host of the Learning Channel series titled The Great Egyptians. In addition to his television and teaching experience, Professor Breyer is the author of several books and scholarly articles. His most recent books include The Murder of Tutankhamun, Egyptian Mummies, Encyclopedia of Mummies, and Daily Life in Ancient Egypt. Each of Professor Breyer's lectures is outlined in the course guide that comes with these tapes. The course guide also includes a glossary, timeline, biographical notes, a bibliography, and the ancient Egyptian alphabet in hieroglyphs. You might find it useful to review the outlines before and after listening to the lectures. Lecture 1, Introduction.
Hi, I'm Bob Breyer, and we're going to be together for 48 lectures, so I think it might be a good idea to convince you that you did the right thing. What I'm going to do this first lecture is I will try to explain to you why it's the right thing to study Egypt, why it's a good thing. But I'll also explain to you how we know what we know about Egypt. We know an incredible amount about Egypt. We don't know as much about, say, the Mayans, or the Assyrians, or the Babylonians, but we know lots about the Egyptians. And I'm going to explain why that is. Another thing I'm going to explain is that there are different approaches to the subject. Different people approach Egyptology in different ways. They have different biases. And I'll explain my bias also. And then I'm going to do some housekeeping. I'm going to tell you how the course is organized. I'm going to explain how we'll be proceeding and what I expect of you. But also, I want to explain the goals. I want to tell you what I expect that you'll get out of this course. But let me start with why you should be learning Egyptology. Now, first, let me say this. There's an element of escapism in it. Egypt is a wonderful place to go when you're tired of the real world, when things get too busy, when things are too hectic. Egypt's a place far, far away in time and space. I can give you an example, a personal example. About 3 years ago now, I had the schedule from hell. I was teaching 5 different courses at 3 different campuses, and it was just crazy. Sometimes I literally didn't know where I was going. I was in the car now. Which course am I teaching now? Where am I going? And to keep my sanity, in the afternoons, when I would get back to my office, I would go to my office, and for a half hour, I would just draw hieroglyphs. I would draw a line of birds, or a line of snakes, or a line of feet. And it was a great escape, and it helped. So there's a kind of psychological reason, I think, why people study Egypt. I mean, I find it in my students at the university. I'll often ask a kid who's an accounting major, I'll say, why are you taking Egyptology? And very often the kid will say, you know, I take loads of accounting courses, loads of economics. This has absolutely no relevance to my life. to my career, and I love it. So there's a kind of psychological reason for doing it. So I think you'll enjoy it for that reason. But there are better reasons, and let me tell you about some of those. Ancient Egypt was the most advanced civilization in the ancient world. Now, there are some people who would disagree with that. The people who study Sumeria, for example, Samuel Noah Kramer was a great scholar on Sumeria, and he wrote a book called History Begins at Sumer, right? And where he outlined all the things that begin in Sumeria. He was wrong. History does not begin in Sumeria. It really starts in Egypt. But that's a bit of my prejudice. But let me explain why Egypt is so special among the cultures of the ancient world. There are so many firsts in Egypt that we all know about that makes Egypt unique. For example, the Sumerians did not build the pyramids of Egypt. The Sumerians did not build the incredible temples we see. The Sumerians did not do medical science the way the Egyptians did. There are loads of firsts in ancient Egypt. That's why Egypt's important. For example, religion. Most people are shocked to learn that monotheism, the belief in one God, is first presented by an Egyptian pharaoh. Monotheism starts in Egypt. Or, for example, mummification. It's the Egyptians who perfected the science of mummification. Or Egyptian mythology. Nothing, no mythology is as rich as Egyptian mythology. I mean, Egypt is incredible. I mean, for example, the Greeks, right? The famous Greeks, the ancient civilization. The Greeks revered ancient Egypt. If you read Greek historians, they all say the same thing. We got our civilization from Egypt. They wanted to trace their lineage back to the Egyptians because the Greeks were sort of Johnny-come-latelys on the scene compared to the Egyptians. You know, you're talking about the Iliad, the Odyssey, maybe being composed around 900 B.C. The pyramids were built, you know, a couple of thousand years earlier. So the Greeks always wanted to trace their... It's like, you know what it's like? It's like when people want to trace their heritage back to the Mayflower. My ancestors came over on the Mayflower. That's what the Greeks did with Egypt. I mean, there's even a wonderful story. When the Greeks were holding the Olympiad, they wanted to figure out how to make it fair. Because there were foreigners who wanted to participate in the Olympiad, in the Olympic Games. And they figured, well, you have Greek officials, Greek officials. How would we make it fair? They might be biased toward the Greeks. So they sent a committee to Egypt because the Egyptians were wise in philosophy. And they asked the Egyptians, how do we make it fair? Right? So the Greeks really wanted to trace everything back to Egypt. So, I mean, there's nothing like Egypt. Let me say another thing. If you ask the ancient Greeks, where did you learn to build your temples? They all said the same thing. We learned to build in stone from the Egyptians. The first building in stone in the history of the world is an Egyptian building. We'll talk about that later. So there's plenty of reasons for studying Egypt. Another reason is I think that Egypt is somewhat mysterious. People look at the hieroglyphs, you know, and they look indecipherable. They're not. They're not. One of the things I'm going to do with you, I hope, in these 48 lectures, is demystify Egypt. But I don't think it'll take any of the wonder away from it, any of the grandeur of Egypt. But I'm going to show you what those birds and snakes and ducks really mean. But there is this mysterious aspect about Egypt. I mean, this is why I think every person who thinks he's reincarnated thinks he was an ancient Egyptian, right? They were never a shoemaker in Brooklyn, right? They're always an ancient Egyptian. So I think that there's this mysterious aspect about Egypt that also draws us to it. And then it's the art. There's nothing like Egyptian art. You know, think about it. You know, you go into a museum and you look at Greek art. And I'm not demeaning Greek art. It's wonderful. The wonderful craters, the large pots, Socratic idols are very stylish, terrific. But it's just not Egyptian art. It's not that colorful, vibrant. There's something special about Egyptian art. And we'll talk about that later, too. So there are plenty of reasons why we should study Egypt. And that's why I think you're going to enjoy it. But let me move on. Let me say that there are various approaches to how to study Egypt. And it's important that you understand these different approaches because they're biases. And I have my bias, and I'll talk about that. The first is what we call the philological approach. Now, philological comes from two Greek words. Philo, which is love, and logos, which is word. It's the love of words. The philologists are the language people. These are the translators. These are the guys who take a really tough text and can translate it. Now, all of us, when I say us, I mean Egyptologists, we can all translate hieroglyphs moderately well. But when you get a really tough text, we go to the philologists. And there is an approach towards the history of Egypt that's philological, through the language. Sir Alan Gardner, great scholar of the 1930s, 1940s, was a philologist. His specialty was language, hieroglyphs. He wrote a history of Egypt. A solid history, lots of good stuff in it. But it's mainly through language. I'll give you an example of how you figure out the history of Egypt through language. Take one pharaoh's name, the pharaoh Mentuhotep, made up of two Egyptian words. Mentu, which is the war god. Right? Mentu was the war god. And Hotep means to be pleased. This is why you get lots of pharaohs whose names are things like Amenhotep, right? Mentuhotep. So it means Mentu, the war god, is pleased. Now, as Sir Alan Gardner points out, that tells you something about the times. Why name a kid Mentuhotep? You know? It means there's war, and you want to be in favor with the war god. So just from the name, we can get an idea of the political times. You know? So there's a philological approach, mainly through texts and analyzing language, of trying to figure out history. And it's a legitimate approach. It's not mine. I'll tell you one drawback. As Alan Gardner's book, you know, it's very solid, as I say. Lots of good information. But it's unreadable. I mean, it's deadly. And I always think, when I look at Alan Gardner's stuff, I always think of a man named Weigel. Arthur Weigel was the inspector of antiquities in the Valley of the Kings when Tutankhamun's tomb was discovered. And he's the best writer on archaeology that you'll find. In the preface to one of his books, Arthur Weigel says, "It's the goal of the archaeology writer to make the dead come alive, not to put the living to sleep." Right? And I think he's right. And this is why I have my approach. And let me explain what my approach is. In my approach to history, I try to emphasize events and the people who made those events happen. We're going to go through Egyptian history learning events and the people involved. I think that's probably the best way to do it. There's just something about people that makes the past come alive. Once we realize that these were not just abstract kings, but real people with the same kind of emotions we have. Ramses the Great, when he went into battle, he was afraid. Don't listen to what he put on his temple wall. He was probably afraid. So I think there are lots of different approaches, and I'm going to try to take the broadest approach. But let me tell you one other approach that I think is also legitimate. The art historical approach. Now, this is the approach that's usually taken by art historians, people who are specialists in art of ancient Egypt. They're usually museum curators. These are the people who are happy in their museums and don't go to Egypt that much. They don't excavate. They're happy to have, say, the objects, the art brought to them. And then these are the people who can look at a fragment of a statue. They can look at, for example, the way the mouth curls downward, just a little piece of a statue, and say, "Ah, look at the way the corner has a drill mark. That didn't start till the late period, so we know this is probably 750 BC or later." Or they can look at an eye, and just from the eyebrow, they can tell you roughly the period, maybe even the pharaoh. And many of these people, when they write their articles, it's reconstructing the history of Egypt through the art. Now, let me say something about the art, because it's amazing how central to Egyptian culture the art was. Now, let me try something out of you that I think you probably never thought about. When you go into a museum with a large collection of Egyptian art, and you look at an Egyptian statue, let's say it's of a pharaoh striding forward. If that statue was carved in 2500 BC, you look at it and you say, Egyptian. You can look at a statue carved 1,000 years later, 1500 BC, you say the same thing. Ah, that's Egyptian. Then you go to ones carved 500 BC. Huh, Egyptian. There's relatively little change. The art didn't change over 3,000 years. And that's a curious factor. You can't do that with any other art. I mean, think about what's happened in Western art in the last 200 years. You know, you go from Picasso to this to that. I mean, from a Madonna and child of the Middle Ages, it's crazy. But Egyptian art never changed. At least, not the broad picture. And let me explain why. And this is why the art historians think what they do is the most important. Egyptian art wasn't supposed to change. They didn't value creativity. The Egyptians did not want innovations. When you carved a statue, you were supposed to carve it for eternity. It was supposed to be the way we've been carving it for hundreds of years. When a sculptor went to make a statue of the gods, he would take out a statue from the temple and copy it. There was supposed to be a certain canon of proportion. Or, for example, and this will surprise you, when somebody painted a tomb painting, the first thing they did was a man would come in and put a grid on the wall, like graph paper. And next, the person who was going to draw the scene would come in. These were specialists. He would come in, and he would make sure that the proportions were right by using the grid. So maybe, for example, three squares were for the head. Then the shoulders had to be seven squares. Then the distance from the shoulder to the knee had to be eight squares. The proportions were always the same. It was supposed to be the same. They were basically reducing Egyptian art to paint by numbers. You know, you were kind of filling in the boxes. And that's because there was a world order. There was a way that art was supposed to be, and it was supposed to stay that way. So you can really trace a lot of the culture from the art. And that's why the art historians do what they do. It's very important to grasp that. You know, I'll tell you an interesting, the way the Greeks viewed Egyptian art. Now, it's surprising, but Plato, right, the philosopher, was in some sense opposed to art. Right? He felt that art was false. Because, you know, when you do a great statue, it looks like the real person. And what you're really at as a philosopher is truth. You want truth. So in a sense, art was a bad thing. But if you read Plato's dialogues, he talks about Egyptian art. And that was okay. Now, why is Egyptian art okay to the Greeks? Or to Plato, a philosopher? The answer is, it didn't try to fool anybody. You know, if you look at those paintings, with those strange paintings where you get a profile face, but a frontal eye, you know, and the shoulders are square, but the head, it's impossible. It's not trying to fool you. It doesn't look like the person. There's a different purpose in Egyptian art. So for the Greeks, Egyptian art was special also. Also, you know, reducing it to sort of paint by numbers, it was these mathematical proportions, the Greeks loved numbers. And Egyptian art was almost art by the numbers. So the art historical approach is a legitimate one also. Very legitimate. But as I say, I'm going to try to put some of these together, use different approaches, be broad, eclectic. And in this course, you'll get a little bit of art history. You'll get a little bit of philology. But mostly we'll get events. I want to show you the events that made Egypt what it was and the people that made those events. Let me tell you about how we know so much about ancient Egypt. As I said before, we don't know that much about the Mayans, and they're more recent. We don't know that much about the Assyrians, the Babylonians. But we know an incredible amount about the Egyptians. And let me explain that. It comes from their belief in life after death. Right? It comes out of religion. The Egyptians were resurrectionists. That means they believed that the body, the physical body, would literally get up and go again in the next world. Now, if you believe that, that the next world is, in a sense, a continuation of this world, you're going to kind of do the same things you did in this world in the next world. If you believe that, you put all your energies into the next world, because that's going to last a lot longer than this one. So they built tombs out of stone to last forever. And on those tomb walls, they painted scenes so the gods could see how they wanted to be treated in the next world. So on the tomb walls, if a guy liked fishing, and many Egyptians loved fishing in the marshes, he would have a scene painted of himself in his boat, fishing. If he liked playing games, right? And the Egyptians have a game similar to chess called Senet. He would have himself painted on the wall, moving the pieces. So these tomb wall scenes are a great little window into ancient Egyptian daily life. Almost everything is there. You can see guys harvesting crops. You can see women weaving, It's all there. So tombs are very important. And it's not just the paintings. They believed you could take it with you. So they filled the tombs with everything they wanted in the next world. So when we discover an intact tomb, it's got everything. It was a little bit like, I often think of it as, imagine you're going on a trip to a country you've never been to. You're not sure what the weather's like. You're not sure what the rules are. So you take everything. You take your umbrella. Right? You take the raincoat just in case it rains there. And that's what the Egyptians did. They tried to take everything. So when you get a complete Egyptian tomb, you get furniture. Right? Guys took their beds. Right? Women took their cosmetics. The games. If you're a pharaoh, you could take your chariot. So Egyptian tombs are a wonderful source of daily life in the ancient Egyptians, right? So one of the reasons we know so much about Egypt is this belief in life after death. There's another great source of how we know what we know. Remember that the Egyptians had writing very early. So they left us a lot of written material, and that's important. And temple walls were like bulletin boards to the ancient Egyptians. If you wanted to tell the world something, you carved it on a temple wall, at least if you were the pharaoh. Now, what the pharaohs carved on the temple walls are a little bit surprising to our culture. Battle scenes. See, it kind of sounds funny to have a war scene in a temple. But remember, the Egyptians weren't into peace. They were on top of the world, and they liked to stay there. So they wanted a constant state of war with victory after victory. So when a pharaoh came back from a victory, he would go to the temple wall. And on the outside of the temple wall, he would carve the story of his victory. And these guys were really a nation of accountants. They listed everything. So you would get the number of captives, the number of people slain. You would get even the names of the pharaoh's horses. We know the names of Ramses the Great's horses. I'll tell you that in another lecture. But they had everything there. So temple walls are a wonderful source of Egyptian history. Also, if the pharaoh sort of wanted to get in good with the gods, he would list all the offerings he had given to the temple that year. So we will have a list of maybe 500-600 different things that the pharaoh gave to the temple. 6,000 jars of wine for the priests. 800,000 loaves of bread. 5,000 bolts of cloth. 16 vessels of sacred oils. So many rings of gold. So we have it all on temple walls. So temple walls are a wonderful source. And because of the climate in Egypt, those temple walls are still there. You know, you can go and see Karnak Temple, some of the walls, just when they were built. They look just like when they were built. So, temple walls are a great source. And there's more sources. We have religious texts, because they were so religious. They wrote down their religion. I mean, the priests, that was the job of the priests. They wrote their religion. Now, one of the things about religious texts is they don't only tell you the religion, they give you an insight into fears, what the people were afraid of. For example, we have books of the dead. Now, a book of the dead was a guidebook of how to get to the next world. And these are long rolls of papyrus. Very often they have illustrations, paintings of the gods. And they tell you how to behave so you're going to get to the next world. They're collections of magical spells. And if you read the spells, you get an idea of what these guys were worried about. For example, there's a spell to get power in your legs. The idea was you've been mummified, you've been dead a while, now you've got to get up and go again, so you better recite the spell for power in your legs. You have to recite a spell for breath to the mouth. There's a spell for making sure that your head isn't cut off. So there were spells for all occasions, and these religious texts give us ideas of what these people were thinking. They were just like us. Now, also, they didn't just put them on papyri. They carved them on their coffins. So we have what we call coffin texts. Magical spells for the next world on coffins. So we have loads of religious texts, and that's another good source, and we'll talk about them also. But there's also literature. You know, I don't know if you realize it, but the Egyptians wrote short stories. They wrote fiction. And they wrote love poetry, too. There's a wonderful genre, love poems of the 18th dynasty. It's really great stuff. So there are plenty of good sources for us to learn the history of Egypt, and we've got to use them all. So I love to use literature. I love that. I mean, I just love reading those stories, and I think you'll enjoy it, too. But there are plenty of ways we have of learning about Egypt. Let me tell you one last source that I think is a good source. Other Egyptologists think it's a bad source. It's Herodotus, a Greek tourist, and I emphasize, he was a tourist, who went to Egypt around 450 B.C. Now, Herodotus was a great guy. He went everywhere. For example, he went to Russia, right? He was in, visited the Scythians. He talks about those burials. He went down into Ethiopia, right? He went everywhere, right? 450 B.C., Egypt was still going on. It was a late period. And he published his works. When I say published, of course, he wrote them down. And the book that he wrote is called Historia. Now, histories. History is the Greek word for research, right? These were his researches. And we get our word history because this is the first history book in the world, right? So we call it history because Herodotus called it. But book two of his researches is all about Egypt. So that's a nice source, somebody who was really there, an eyewitness account in 450 B.C. of Egypt, what was going on. Now, the reason I say some people don't think he's a good source, and we have to be careful with how we use Herodotus, very careful. He didn't speak the language. He was undoubtedly working through translators, probably had a guide, like a tourist guide, and some of the things he was told weren't necessarily true. He has some strange stories that he tells, really strange. For example, Herodotus says that carved on the Great Pyramid of Egypt was how many onions and breads and things the workmen were given for working on the pyramid. Now, it doesn't seem right. The pharaoh's not going to build this great pyramid as his tomb and then say, all right, let's put the onions and breads that the guys are given. I think what happened was Herodotus was being taken around by this guide, who was probably illiterate, couldn't read what was inscribed on the pyramid, and they said, Herodotus says, hey, what does that say? And like most guides in Egypt, he made it up. And he said, oh, it says the bread and the beers. So there are many things that are inaccurate in Herodotus. But he's still a good source for many things. So he is one way we have of learning about ancient Egypt. And we'll be talking about Herodotus. But let me tell you a little bit about how we're going to organize this course, how it's going to work. As I said, I'm going to try to do it by emphasizing people. Now, let me say one thing about this person-centric approach, right, sort of personalizing Egypt. There are two theories about what makes Egypt great. One of the theories is geography, that the Nile is what makes Egypt great. Now, as you probably know, the Nile overflows each year, overflows its banks. And as it overflows, it deposits rich topsoil that enabled the Egyptians to grow plentiful crops. And there's a tremendous consequence of this. If you can grow more food than you need, you can support a large number of people, who don't contribute to your economy. And what large number of people are you going to support? An army. Egypt could support a standing army. Now, a standing army, at first, doesn't contribute to the economy. But once it marches out of Egypt, conquers foreign lands, and brings back tribute, then it's really helping the economy. So some people say that it's the Nile that made Egypt great. Even Herodotus, our tourist, he made the famous statement. He said, Egypt is the gift of the Nile. He meant that literally, that the Nile brings the soil, the very soil of Egypt, and deposits it. So that's one theory of what makes Egypt great, geography. Now, I'm sure it's more than that, though. I mean, that's part of it, of course. I mean, the Nile enabled them to support also not just an army, but priests. They could start having a whole leisure class who could do nothing but think about religion. So the Nile is an important factor, but also it's the personalities. Egypt was always ruled by a pharaoh, a king with absolute power, a god on earth. And if you had a pharaoh who was a great man, you could do great things. So that's why I say I think it's also the personalities, and I'll be stressing the personalities. But as we go through this history, we're going to do it chronologically. I'm going to start at the beginning, the very beginning. And we're going to go all the way down from building of the pyramids through the great personalities, and we'll end with Cleopatra, the last ruler of Egypt. Right? So we will go chronologically with some side trips. When it's appropriate, we'll do a lecture on mummification, for example, which is my specialty. You've probably gathered by now that Egyptologists come in different flavors. There are those who are the art historians who are interested in the art. There's the philologist interested in the language. Well, my specialty is really mummification, or more broadly, diseases in the ancient world, paleopathology, old suffering. I'm interested in studying mummies to try to figure out what the Egyptians suffered from. So we'll have side tours. We'll do a separate lecture, for example, on magic. But mainly chronologically. Now, let me say something about dates. Don't try to memorize them. You won't remember them anyway, and they're not that important. I always tell my students, what's important is you get the relative chronology. In other words, it's important to know that the pyramids were built when Egypt was just beginning. That when Tutankhamun was placed in his tomb, the pyramids were 1,000 years old. Egypt lasted so long that they had archaeologists excavating in Egypt to figure out who did what, right? Or when Cleopatra ruled, Tutankhamun had been dead for 1,000 years. So what's important is that you get the idea of what came before what. Don't worry about the dates. They're not crucial. Now, I said the last thing I wanted to do today is tell you about the goals, what I hope that you'll get out of this course. And I have a few goals, right? One is, I would like you all, of course, to have a broad knowledge of Egyptian history, including, I want you to know something about architecture, about the religion, about the politics, how it was structured, right? But also, of course, and I'm not an art historian, I want you to have a better appreciation of Egyptian art. What I would love is if at the end of these lectures, these 48 lectures, you could go into a museum, into the Egyptian section, and look at a statue and say, ah, idealized form, that must be Old Kingdom. Or, oh look, he looks tired. That must be the pharaoh Sesostris, or one of the Sesostrises. There were several who had that view. Or, ah, look at that, must be Ptolemaic, must be one of the Ptolemies. So I would like you to be able to say, take a friend on a tour of the Egyptian Museum and just explain it all. And I think that's reasonable. But maybe the most important goal is I don't want it to stop with the 48th lecture. What I would hope is that after these lectures, you want to continue learning about Egypt. That's the important thing. And in the bibliography, I've got societies listed that you can join, publications you can subscribe to. There's an awful lot that you can do after these lectures. And that's my real goal, that I just sort of give you the beginning of the learning. With that said, let me tell you what we'll do next time. As I said, we're going to do it chronologically. We're going to begin at the beginning, and we will start with prehistory, ancient Egypt before writing. So I'll see you next time.